welcome to the F1 Strategy Report for Formula Legend. On this week's edition, the Austrian Grand Prix, who hit who in the fight for the lead on the last lap? And just how did Jenson Button finish sixth? That's all to come in this edition of the Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and my guest this week for what was a surprisingly strategically thrilling Austrian Grand Prix, it must be said, and there's no doubt you'll know the voice. He almost doesn't need an intro, but convention dictates I give him one. His surname is not in the pit lane, it is Kravitz, first name Ted. He joins me, how are you?
Hello, yeah, good, all right. Got a bit of a cold, but yeah, otherwise fine, thank you.
That's just the mark of Formula One in this huge month of racing, really. It's really, what is it, like 5 races in 6 weeks or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. It's the two back-to-backs. Yeah, it is tough on everyone.
And only one race in, so we'll keep you in our thoughts as we go through the next couple of rounds. Yeah. Of course, the British Grand Prix next, that's for another day, of course, but I'm sure that'll be exciting nonetheless, given that the defining moment of the Austrian Grand Prix was, well, it was what's soon becoming a kind of age-old battle, isn't it, between Rosberg and Hamilton. We've got to start with this crash, because this is really the cumulative point of this entire race. But if, for those who didn't see it, it was Rosberg essentially trying to run Hamilton wide. Didn't work out for Rosberg. What did you make of that? What was your reaction at the very moment it happened, Ted?
Well, bear in mind that I don't actually have a TV in the pit lane, so... Sorry to come over all Football Manager about this, but I don't often see these things until after, because my job in the pit lane is to commentate on things that the commentators don't see, and that you can't see on the TV. Otherwise, there'd be no point. If I was just a lot of pit commentators, I won't name names, but you know, they don't join me in the pit lane. They just commentate on stuff that they're watching on TV. And I've always thought there's absolutely no point to doing that, because if you're doing that, you might as well be a commentator or a third commentator. So I only got to see it later on. And it just seemed to me to be a sort of continuation of this, you know, macho, I'll show you who runs people out and who doesn't argument that Hamilton and Rosberg have been having. They had it in Canada. Mm-hmm. Didn't they? When one of them was on the outside, and he said, "Well, you shouldn't have been on the outside," and Rosberg went onto the grass, and then they had it in a race earlier on in the year as well. So it's just a sort of continuation of the kind of, you know, I'm not going to give way, almost Senna-esque. You know, if you continue on this line, son, we're going to have an accident. So it's a bit of a sort of macho fest, and they'd both rather, and they've kind of said this, admitted this, that they would both rather crash and not score any points for either of them than one of them give way and to show weakness to the other one. And I guess that's the point at which we've got to between these two.
It turns out that friendly pool chat we heard so much about in the last fortnight didn't work out so well. I think what's fascinating about it, there are a couple of interesting things in this accident. As you said, it sort of was that continuation of I dare you to crash, essentially. And we've seen heaps of them. We've seen, as you said, there was Montreal this year, there was Japan last year, Austin last year. But it seemed like after Spain, when they actually did crash into each other properly, let's say, and both were out of the race, that it almost seemed like that was Rosberg finally gaining that psychological advantage, I guess, in the sense that Hamilton knew the door would be closed. And yet it seemed like Rosberg took what I would have called an unnecessary step in this situation and really did try to push him really wide. I mean, what's your take on the fact that Rosberg did take this extra step now and didn't do, I guess, what we all expected him to do and generally race kind of fair in those situations?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he had a brake problem. So the irony of the whole thing is that if Hamilton had just tried to outbrake him and then cut back to the right-hand side into that massive gap of nowhere on the apex, mm-hmm. That Rosberg was saying that there wasn't room, or he, you know, he hadn't left him any room, whatever, then Hamilton probably would have got by and it would have been a very clean move. Obviously, Lewis didn't know that Rosberg had critical brake problems. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing could have been achieved probably one corner later, or even on that same corner. But if Lewis had just driven clean around the outside, given him even more room, but I suppose then he would have been in the gravel without contact. But I don't know. I mean, to answer your question, it just seemed a little clumsy. But, you know, lots of people have said, look, Rosberg can't race clean. He ran him off the road. Look, he doesn't even try to make the corner. And, you know, those views have all got merit. But I don't know. I'm not going to start saying, you know, blaming Rosberg for... Or rather, I'm not going to start saying, you know, Rosberg can't race, because there's plenty of evidence to suggest he can. But yeah, he did kind of mess it up on this occasion.
Mm-hmm. And certainly as a final point on this, I do like that over the course of this rivalry, you've managed to collect, I think, some of Toto Wolff's finest moments. He had his unacceptable race face on yesterday when you found him.
Yeah.
And this time it was brainless, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I found his reaction... slightly puzzling. I thought that we'd reached a kind of threshold of acceptance that this kind of thing was going to happen. It was almost like Toto had wound himself up and wanted to share that. I mean, after Spain, he was very well advised to play it cool. And, you know, Ferrari aren't the threat for the championship that they thought or we thought or that neutrals hoped they would be. Same for Red Bull. You know, Mercedes are going to win both championships this year. So what if they bash into each other now and again? Play it cool, Toto. You know, all right, okay, if you want to send a message to people working at Brackley and Brixworth that, you know, the drivers haven't respected the job they've done, I think he was, or the job of the mechanics rebuilding Rosberg's car in record time after FP3, I think that's probably what Toto was most annoyed about, was that it did show that, you know, they were heading for a 1-2. And the drivers have made sure that it wasn't, and it could have been a double DNF, it wasn't. The drivers have made sure that it wasn't going to be a 1-2, and that somehow, you know, that was you know, the most terrible thing they could do, and he was there to defend the mechanics and everybody working in the factory's interests by, you know, publicly saying on TV that it was brainless. But he's got himself into a corner now, Toto, because he's talking about, you know, we might impose team orders. Now this morning Lewis Hamilton's coming out saying, please don't impose team orders. I don't know, maybe Toto's playing a incredibly intelligent triple bluff here. If he comes out so strongly and says there might be team orders, he expects then the drivers to say, please, sir, don't impose team orders, to which he goes back and says, okay, I won't impose team orders if you two behave. So maybe that's the sort of... Maybe he's thinking three steps ahead. I wouldn't put it past him. He's quite a clever bloke. But yeah, I was a bit surprised he came out so strong. I thought he'd play a bit cooler than that.
Especially as, I think you pointed out, it had been 30 races since the last accident before Spain. When he was playing it so cool, maybe he thinks that maybe they were taking a little bit of an advantage of the new cool dad syndrome.
You know, and they still won the race. And more to the point, for team harmony, Lewis won the race, because if Lewis hadn't won the race, and we'll get onto this, I'm sure, in a minute, actually, it would have been worse for team harmony than Toto, and that would have been a bigger problem than Toto's got at the moment.
Yeah, and now let's go back in time. That was the crash, that was the end of the race, but let's go back to the beginning, because this was ultimately set up by a variety of different factors, both beforehand and in the race. In fact, the entire complexion of the race changed halfway through. But as we sort of saw a lot last year, and we can use Austin as the extreme example, the really extreme example, let's be honest, where if there isn't enough representative practice, there's a little bit of guesswork in the race. And we saw this on this weekend as well, because all the practice days and qualifying included, the conditions were quite different to race day, whether it was raining or really warm. Race day was just really mild and cool, and as a result, we weren't really sure exactly what the limit of all the tyres were.
Yeah.
Let's start with the Ultrasoft as one example. Lewis Hamilton, his strategy started with a really long stint on the Ultrasoft, when in FP3, just 24 hours earlier, really, he was struggling to get even a handful of laps out of it. I mean, what was the rationale for Mercedes giving that a go, given the data they'd collected?
Well, the weather was the rationale, because it was boiling hot on Saturday morning in FP3 when they blistered the Ultrasoft tyres. And then it rained, and then it kept raining, and then by Sunday it was 15 degrees, almost 20 degrees cooler than it was on Saturday morning. So that gave Mercedes the confidence that they could go on a one stop on the Ultrasoft tyres for Lewis, which is what they did.
Mm-hmm. Although ultimately that strategy changed, didn't it? And we'll get actually to Vettel in a moment, because one of the things we should talk about pre-race was the fact that the story that's been simmering all year has been the tyre pressures and who's been abusing them and who hasn't been. And the FIA has taken action in this sense. I mean, ultimately, it's just they're measuring it at a different time. But I mean, how much A did tyre pressures come into this, and also the resurfacing of this track, which actually made the tyres generate more heat than they would have otherwise done, play into all of that? The fact that the cooler conditions, we still saw a competitive Ferrari, for example.
Yeah, the tyre pressures thing, there was a tightening up on the rules as to when they're measured. I think the real answer to that is to perfect the live tyre pressure monitoring systems during the race. They say at the moment, the FIA says they can't do that because they can't trust the teams not to build in an offset into their data acquisition, and then offset it in the data that they then pass on to the FIA and to Pirelli to tell them exactly accurately what their tyre pressures are when they're on the car in the middle of the race. I think there's a way around that. I think the FIA just put their own sensors on there, that's a bit of a bigger thing. But the only way around it, of course, because all the teams are complying with the rules, which is that the tyre pressures are at a minimum level when the tyre is fitted to the car and before it goes off in the race. But what those tyre pressures are during the race, when it's on the car, no one knows. Well, the teams know, but and Pirelli say that they are less than the mandated pressures, so they're still getting around it somehow. Track resurfacing. It was a darker tarmac, and it was much grippier, and there were part of the circuits, some corners which were much faster as well. That did have an impact, I guess, to a limited extent.
And one of the other, well, let's say tentative unknowns, because as we record this, we should add that as a caveat, we don't exactly know what's gone on. Pirelli's still investigating, but potentially one of the things that wasn't found out, let's say, before the race or wasn't known, was exactly how long these tyres should have lasted. Although it must be said, when Sebastian Vettel's super soft tyre did explode about halfway through the race, or a little bit before halfway through the race, actually, it should have been within the window of its expected tyre life, but that's still remaining unknown. In fact, I think someone was saying that Pirelli initially tweeted that it was debris and then deleted that tweet and now say it might not have been debris. Is this a Pirelli issue in the similar vein that we saw, was it Belgium last year on Sebastian Vettel's car, as it happened, or is this a Ferrari problem, or do you think it was an external factor?
Well, I don't know. I mean, who knows what tyre pressures Ferrari were running that tyre during the race, whether they were below the Pirelli mandated pressures. You know, we don't know. We assume that it wasn't below, but we don't know, and Ferrari certainly won't tell us that. The tyre was certainly within its expected life, not only for performance but also for pure wear. I mean, not only for degradation, which affects performance, but also, you know, for pure wear. It was within that life. It was also, Ferrari tell us, within the temperature range in which it was designed to work. I think it was probably more likely to be a bit of heavy curb action on that tyre that induced a weakness into it. Obviously, had Vettel pitted earlier, then they wouldn't have had this. So there is, but Ferrari weren't to know that it was going to it was going to explode like that. There could have been some debris. I mean, bits fall off Formula One cars all the time. So there could have been a little bit of debris there. But I think in a day or two, Pirelli probably will come out and say it was a bit of debris and excessive curb damage, and then everyone will kind of accept that and move on. Probably apart from Sebastian Vettel, whose attitude towards Pirelli tyres I don't think was changed much by the events in Austria.
Maybe Paul Hembree and Sebastian need some time by the pool as well. Yeah. I hope that FOM subtitles its Austrian Grand Prix review as some heavy curb action. I think that would be a great title. I'd watch it. That's another story altogether, really, the curbs. But up until that point, where Sebastian Vettel's tyre eventually did give way, we were on for a very different race to what we ultimately had. Because we had Vettel and Rosberg engaged in this fight through the field, and we had Hamilton leading out front with a possible threat from Kimi Raikkonen, who had, after a week where everyone was asking when he's going to retire, had a typically, worthwhile performance, I suppose we can say. And it was going to be a battle of how long can or how far can we push this one-stop strategy. In the end, we saw that Mercedes had to do a two-stop, or they felt it was safer to do a two-stop. If we theoretically got this, let's say, hypothetical race, the first half of it played out, how do you feel like it could have ended, given what we know about Mercedes' feelings about tyre life towards the end and the fact that Raikkonen did complete a reasonably competitive one-stop?
Yeah, okay, right. So now we're getting on to the really interesting stuff. And I said mm-hmm. a little bit earlier, I said a few minutes ago, that Lewis was on a one-stop, which is what he did. You're right, he didn't do that. He did a two-stop. But what I meant was that he should have done a one-stop.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think, is the crux of Mercedes' curious strategy in Austria and why I think mistakes were made and why Lewis Hamilton was so annoyed in the car, and he wasn't so annoyed afterwards because he won the race, but why he felt aggrieved that he was found himself consistently behind Nico Rosberg. Because you're right, the first race was between Lewis Hamilton and Kimi Raikkonen and potentially Sebastian Vettel. So when And it was very clear when Nico Rosberg pitted on lap 10, that was clear that he was going to do a two-stop. Presumably Lewis Hamilton knew that. And Lewis Hamilton was going to do a one-stop. And they let the gap. He wasn't racing. Hamilton wasn't racing Rosberg at that point, which is why if we take lap 15 as an example, Rosberg was 27 seconds behind Hamilton. You go a few laps later, lap 19, Rosberg was 23 seconds behind Hamilton. Now, if the race was between Hamilton and Rosberg, which is what it ended up being after the Ferraris had fallen out of the picture, then Mercedes would have pitted Lewis Hamilton on lap 20 when his gap to Rosberg was 21 seconds, because you need 20 seconds, including a sort of average 3-second pit stop to do a pit stop and still remain out in front. So they would have pitted Hamilton 10 laps later than Rosberg on lap 20, and Hamilton would have kept track position out in front. Hamilton would have gone to the end, and Rosberg could have gone to the end if his tyres would have taken it. And even if they didn't do that, they could have left it as long as they did to ensure that Hamilton didn't do too many laps on his tyres, and pit Hamilton one lap later, as it was. If we take lap 20, actually they pitted on him on lap 21, so they did kind of do that. But by lap 21, Rosberg was 16 seconds behind Hamilton, so Rosberg was guaranteed to take the lead, which he did. He took track position over Hamilton. It wasn't helped that Hamilton had a couple of slow stops. But in that situation, so Hamilton knows that Rosberg's ahead of him, but Rosberg has to stop again. And Hamilton's told by his team that he's on a one stop. And so he knows that he'll retake the lead after Rosberg stops for his second stop. But then what do we get? Well, once the Ferraris are out of the picture, we get Mercedes bringing Hamilton in again for a second stop. Before Rosberg, let's not forget, before Rosberg makes his second stop. So that is the curious thing. And actually, it's not just me saying this, and I've copped a bit of flack, as I believe you say, in Australia for championing Hamilton's cause, and the usual sort of prejudicial views that we love Lewis Hamilton on Sky F1. I would be saying this about any driver in this position, because this is what happened. They didn't need to make a second stop. Why did Mercedes make a second stop
mm-hmm.
with Hamilton? They just didn't need to. And I think Lewis was a bit perplexed when they called him in on lap 54. I think he said in his interviews, didn't know why they were doing that, but anyway, I did that. They make the calls, it set up the crash that we spoken about earlier. It's not just me saying this. On the flight back from Graz to Luton, I checked with a couple of other engineers, strategy people from other teams, and they too didn't understand why Hamilton had made a second stop, why Mercedes had brought Hamilton in to make a second stop, which set up all this aggro. A colleague of mine did ask Paddy Lowe this very question, and Paddy said that we believed that when Rosberg stopped for his second stop, which was on lap 56? Yes, it was. 55. They believed that Rosberg, on quicker tyres or fresher tyres, would have caught and passed Hamilton in the remaining 15 laps or so. Well, if you look at the... Is that true? If you look at the lap analysis, that doesn't really bear out. So Hamilton's... If we take Hamilton's lap times around lap 50 or 51, this is three laps before he was going to come into the pits, they're fine. You know, they're pretty solid. And Hamilton was looking after the tyres, whichever compound he was on. So the tyres, the times, his times were a 109.3, 109.5, 109.2, 108.8. And that was on lap 52 when he was starting to push, because he got the instruction to push before his second stop. So all of those times in the 109s, he could have continued with that to the end of the race. And Rosberg, if you look at Rosberg's times on fresh tyres, which gives a clue as to how quick he would have been, or indeed how quick he was on fresh tyres towards the end, he was only closing Hamilton down by an average of about half a second, maybe if you're generous. Well, hey, even 3/4 of a second. Even if you're not generous, even if you say it's a second a lap, he only had 15 laps in which to do that. He would have had 55 to 65, that's 10, 66, 67, 68, 69, 70, that's 15, and 71. So, all right, 16 laps. So he would have been, Rosberg would have been he would have been catching Hamilton, no question about it, on fresher tyres, had Hamilton not made that second stop. But he would have run out of laps before he could have overtaken him. He would have been about four laps short of properly overtaking him.
It's an interesting situation for Mercedes. And before we touch on what is possibly the other strategic question, I suppose, over at Ferrari, if we can call it that exactly, I mean, do you feel like in that situation, we're talking about this two-race concept whereby what they were racing for changed quite dramatically, or changed in any case after that safety car? Yeah. Given that Mercedes has obviously the history of tension, given they've got two competing drivers for the world championship, how do you feel like... And we talked about, I suppose, inter-team harmony at the beginning of this as well. Had they been racing each other as they ultimately were in that second half, and only one of the drivers had to complete a stop, do you feel like that ultimately would have been more detrimental to that harmony, given ultimately it was kind of like a half race we had at the end where they both completed a stop each?
Well, I think this is a crucial point, and I think you've picked up on why they switched Lewis from a one to a two, because it's this desire for fairness. So they have to be fair to both their drivers, and this is a central part of Mercedes' strategy, and in a way they sometimes screw themselves with how fair they have to be to their drivers. We've seen that before. So going into it, they said, and I've, you know, it's on Paddy Lowe's quotes on Mercedes' press release, you know, go read it for yourself. Paddy says, our intention was to put Lewis on a one and Nico on a two. But then we realized that Nico's two would be quicker than Lewis's one. All right, I'm doubting that. The lap times doubt that, but okay, that's what Paddy says. So we switched Lewis onto a two. Yeah, okay, they did, but... So in their attempt to be fair, they set up this problem for themselves, I would suggest. That when Lewis had a... And Lewis didn't help by, you know, the team didn't give him a quick pit stop. In fact, he lost time in both pit stops. That didn't help, A. And B, Lewis didn't help his own chances of making a two-stop work by messing out the outlap and losing a couple of seconds on that. So it's this desire to be fair and thinking, oh no, if we keep Lewis on a one and Nico on a two, Nico's going to beat him. So let's just be fair and put them on the same strategy. That kind of got them into this mess a bit. But yeah, it's, you know, I was saying in the commentary that talking about, you know, fairness, but I was only really reflecting, I was partly playing devil's advocate, but I was partly reflecting what Lewis Hamilton is going to be thinking as well, because that's clearly what he was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the end of the race I did a slightly silly question to, well, I didn't phrase my question particularly well to Niki Lauda when I said, was there a moral obligation to give Lewis the better strategy to allow him to win the race? I think that's where I copped a load of flack, because people thought, well, hang on, nobody has a moral obligation to win any race. And they're absolutely right. I just phrased it wrong. But my intention was that did the team feel like they had to give Lewis, you know, keep giving him the best strategy,
mm-hmm.
because they thought the strategy they thought they'd given him, which would be advantageous, turned out they thought not to be advantageous. And from that point, they were all in a bit of a muddle as to, okay, well, hang on, how are we going to make amends here? How are we going to make up for this strategy that we thought we were giving Lewis, which was going to win him the race, but now at which point we seriously doubt is going to win him the race, and that it's going to give Rosberg the race, and that will mean we get a grumpy Lewis. We don't want a grumpy Lewis, because everybody knows what happens when you get a grumpy Lewis. So, yeah, if anyone's listening to this, somewhat perturbed by my question to Lauda. That was the intention behind that, and I absolutely stand by that, because, you know, as it turned out, if the crash hadn't happened and Rosberg had held him off and didn't have brake problems and all of that, and it had finished Rosberg 1, Hamilton 2,
mm-hmm.
you know, we would be having an apoplectic Lewis Hamilton. There would be a bigger fallout to this.
Mm-hmm.
Than there is at the moment.
Maybe it's that we're in some kind of parallel universe where Toto Wolff was describing his own team as brainless. Maybe this was completely misunderstood.
No. They just got themselves. I mean, we saw. I didn't see this again, but did you see? Did Lewis Hamilton like not shake the strategist James Vowles' hand when they were in the cool down room or something? Did you see this? Or?
I don't know. I wouldn't have noticed if I saw it. I did know that he very intentionally sprayed James Vowles with champagne when he clearly said, please don't.
Okay.
That's more of a podium thing, I think.
And then he hugged him. But there was something, someone said to me in the airport, and I stress, I haven't seen this, that James put his hand out to shake Lewis's hand, and either Lewis blanked him or didn't see him. I've got no idea. I haven't actually checked it back, but... maybe some of your viewers will know what I'm talking about. Our listeners will know what I'm talking about. But I hope that wasn't a snub, because James Vowles has won Lewis, you know, a lot of races and a lot of championships. So if Lewis felt that he was being disadvantaged, you know, he might have had cause to do that, and maybe he was a bit more annoyed about the tire choice. That Rosberg was put onto super softs and Lewis was put onto another set of softs. Actually, that's a red herring. Lewis shouldn't have been concerned about that, because the soft was the better race tire, which proved to be. And apart from the fact that Rosberg didn't have any sets of soft tires left, so they didn't have a choice. They had no choice. They had to put Rosberg on the... I guess they could have put Lewis on the super soft. But actually, as it turned out, the soft was a better race tire.
Now, let's talk about the remnants. That was race A, let's say, the race for the lead. Let's talk about the remnants of race B, though, because that played out ultimately into what was second and third. Possibly should have been third and fourth, but nonetheless. Verstappen and Raikkonen did complete the one stop, which was, I guess, part of that original race.
Yeah, if Verstappen and Raikkonen completed it, then why couldn't have Hamilton have completed it?
Well, that's a fair point, certainly, considering how late Hamilton stopped compared to Verstappen.
Compared to them, exactly. Exactly.
And Verstappen became, as far as I know, the first appearance of Lederhosen on a Formula 1 podium. Yeah. At least faux Lederhosen, anyway. Yeah. I don't know if vinyl print counts, but anyway. Raikkonen seemed to be quite strong on the one stop. Do you feel like, given that the car was clearly capable of it, as it turned out, likewise the Red Bull car, as it turned out, that there were missed opportunities? Let's start with Ferrari, first of all, given that their season's been an entire book of missed opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to see what had happened with Sebastian Vettel, I think, as everybody would. The one stop was possible. You know, Raikkonen showed that, Verstappen showed that, and why that wasn't apparent to Hamilton's pit wall, you know, remains to be seen. But if we sort of pick the race around when Sebastian Vettel was still in contention around, I don't know, say lap 25 or 24, something like that. You know, Sebastian Vettel was out in front. He had Nico Rosberg behind him, and then 20 seconds behind him, he had Romain Grosjean and Kimi Raikkonen. So when Vettel eventually made his stop, he would have come out behind Raikkonen, and they would have both gone to the end. Lewis would have been, you know, in amongst that, and eventually might have challenged them. But it was a missed opportunity. I'm still trying to figure out. Obviously, we know what happened to Vettel, but I'm still trying to figure out exactly why Raikkonen's race ended the way it did.
Well, it was given that he seemed to be shadowing, it was Hamilton at the time, I guess, and they dropped him into traffic at that first stop behind both Red Bulls.
Yeah, I'm just having a look at when Kimi pitted, and his lap times do reflect that, is that he pitted on lap 22, did Kimi, and then you're right, he lost an awful lot of time, and that was before the safety car. So the safety car also kind of wrecked Kimi's race. Mm-hmm. As well, and after that he never really recovered, apart from, of course, the surprise at the end. But it was Verstappen managed to get track position on him, didn't he, when they pitted Kimi. So after the safety car sorted itself out, if we sort of rejoin the race, you know, lap 30 when it sorted itself out, then yeah, you're absolutely right, Kimi was behind the two Red Bulls, Ricciardo immediately in front of him, and then Verstappen in front of him. So that was the early stop for the Red Bulls was great, and it was Max who managed to make the tyres last, whereas Ricciardo didn't. So yeah, a bit messy for Kimi, not all of his own doing, and you can certainly call it, you know, missed opportunities. But I don't know, they seem to be plodding on. They think it will turn. The tide will turn for them eventually.
Mm. And wonder if they'll still be saying that by the end of the season. That's the question.
Yeah.
A couple of quick ones as well that would be remiss of us not to mention in this race. Jenson Button, when Button was following Hamilton off the line, it was like a reminiscent scene of years gone past.
And
ultimately, he couldn't hold it. But to be fair to him, what was it? Finished sixth, which is a pretty good result considering no one really rated him in this race. And also, I think McLaren Honda themselves said, "Oh, look for about 12th. Higher than 12th will be good." I mean, this shows there's a bit of hope in this team now, surely.
Well, hope's kind of all they've got. So yeah, I hope that is the case. But this was a great strategy, and this was a clear case of when being aggressive works. Because Jensen stopped on lap 9, and then again, just before the safety car, when Vettel had his accident, they were straight in and changed tyres because they were in the right part of the track to react quickly. They knew it would be a safety car, and they stopped on lap 26 and went to the end. So that was another car that showed that they could go from lap 26 to the end on one set of tyres. Should have pointed to Lewis Hamilton not having to make that second stop. But anyway, yeah, it was a nice strategy by Jensen. Took advantage of a lot of other people, looked after his tyres, and got a deserved sixth place. But it was a nice example, yeah, of a sort of aggressive, early race tilted, you know, slightly offset strategy to a couple of early stops. You know, and finishing all his pit stops on lap 26 of a 71 lap race, you know, is just an example of what I'm saying. You know, you sort of start early and aggressive when the tyres are having a hard time because of the fuel level, and then nurse it home, which is what he did.
And another standout, in fact, arguably the standout of the race. In fact, I think you gave him one of your stars at the end of the race in your notebook.
Yep.
Was Pascal Wehrlein, yep, who ran a similar-ish strategy to Jenson Button, with the noted example that he was last behind the safety car and came home to finish 10th. Only slightly fortuitous given Sergio Perez's crash at the end, but the rest was very well earned for the Manor driver.
It was, and it was all helped by the qualifying position, mm-hmm, of 12th on the grid, and you know, thank heavens for him that he knew the rule that before the light was on you could actually reverse back into your pit box, because
yeah,
that was a real get out of jail free card. And I was watching the race director watch Wehrlein,
mm-hmm,
and Charlie was nice, actually. Charlie Whiting, he was very nice, actually. He let Wehrlein reverse, and only when he saw Wehrlein was actually back in his correct pit box did he start the light sequence to start the race. So Charlie did Pascal a favor there, because he could have just ignored him, seen that he was in the wrong box, started the start light procedure, and then given Wehrlein a penalty, or rather suggested to the stewards that they give Wehrlein a penalty in the race. But he didn't do that, and so yeah, so running as high as Wehrlein did throughout the race, and yes, you know, you can say that it was down, but you're right, he was dead last. Carlin number 94, he was dead last around to the mid lap 30s for quite a few laps, actually. But then the Saubers started pitting, and everybody pitted for the second time, and Harry Anto's teammate got out of the way as well, and he just edges himself back up, as you say, slightly fortuitously by other people. Suddenly they had a rash of people dropping out: Alonso, Hülkenberg, Massa, towards the end of the race, Perez with brake problems and or teams just wanting to save the car and get a new gearbox for Silverstone. But yeah, from being last to 10th, good effort.
Yeah, not bad. I think that's the least we can say of him. And certainly an interesting battle between the Manor drivers still to go, whether or not that lasts the whole season, up to the midway, I guess we'll find out. And a final note, the man that a lot of people will have been watching, not only given that he's a Le Mans winner and in a Force India that, well, has been looking pretty handy the last couple of races, was Nico Hülkenberg. But that car just really seemed nowhere once the race started, despite the qualifying pace being really pretty good.
Yeah, it was strange, wasn't it? I was kind of asking around, and they were just talking about brake issues and race long brake problems. I don't know. I think the car rather cooked the tires, and I wondered if the setup they had was most suited for quick warm up of the tires that they knew would help them in wet conditions, and indeed did. But then when it came to it, actually, the tires degraded quite significantly. He was one of the first in, if not the first, on lap 8 for his first stop, Hülkenberg. So that was really early. And then lap again lap 24, and then again while they were trying to get to the end on that set of soft tires from lap 24, which plenty of other people's managed, it just became very difficult, and I think they might have picked up a flat spot, and Hülkenberg had to pit again on lap 50 when he served his 5-place penalty for speeding in the pit lane. There was a penalty as well, of course, for Hülkenberg, wasn't there? So that didn't do anything to help his race. So yeah, it was a disappointing result. And I think I saw a tweet from Vijay Mallya this morning saying that he's absolutely gutted for his team's performance. You would have thought he's got bigger things to worry about at the moment, but no, he seems absolutely gutted for his team's performance, and I'm sure he is. But nice to know he's still keeping in touch, even though we haven't seen him at the track recently.
No, gutted's the word of the weekend. I think everyone's had their turn using it, I believe. A final note, Ted, to wrap this up, and also to look ahead at Silverstone and beyond, this was a good example, Austria, of the new tyre rules, because we saw all three tyres for 2016 being used And also, what I think has been really interesting, while this has always been an option in the past, it seems to be utilized certainly this year, the idea of starting on a different tire because you have the option in Q2 of having a tire that can still get you through to Q3. And we saw the Ferraris and Red Bull cars do it. How much, certainly from your perspective, as the guy who really has to keep an eye on all these things and use strategy to tell the story, that how big an advantage or how big a boon for Formula One, rather, has these new rules been? And do you feel that there's still that risk that everyone's just going to end up following, you know, the same pattern, which was the fear last year when the rules was changed? Because that hasn't really come to pass yet.
No, it hasn't. And people are effectively following a similar pattern because the truth of it is that nobody who has ever tried one of those contra tire strategies in terms of starting on a different compound, that they've never won. You look back on it, it's never been a winning strategy. So you could argue, all right, well, maybe it hasn't because it's a bit of a risk, and by definition, trying something different, a contra strategy, means that you don't think you're going to win on the same strategy as the people who are out front, so you're going to try something different because otherwise you're just guaranteed to finish behind them. But it didn't work for Ferrari or Mercedes or Red Bull in Austria. And actually, Hamilton's Ultrasofts lasted just as long as the Ferrari's Supersofts and longer than Red Bull's Supersoft. So that didn't work at all for Red Bull, did it? But those contra strategies have never won a race so far, and I don't see them doing it. But to answer your other question, yes, I think it's great. We've got, you know, it's spiced up the racing very nicely. It's given people a bit more to think about and to look at, with the only drawback being that, as Martin Brundle said in the commentary, we do end up talking a lot more about tyres. Mm-hmm. And tyres are inherently dull. They are. I'm sorry, you know, listen, I make my living on talking about them, but I try not to whenever possible because they are inherently boring. So, well, they're not boring. They're just, it's just a bit, because what they mean isn't boring. Mm-hmm. It doesn't become, you know, what they, the races and the battles that they contribute to aren't boring, but it's just, you know, to most people and to me as a fan as well, because that's all I am, I'm just a fan watching a race just like everybody else, but from a lucky, privileged position, you just say the word tires and I'm like, oh dear. You know, it's like they are a bit dull. So, they have led to is some really fascinating storylines in races.
Mm-hmm. Black round Pirelli, as they say. Ted Kravitz, it was a really interesting Austrian Grand Prix, as it turned out, for maybe not all the reasons Mercedes wanted it to be, but certainly for us. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Okay, no problem. Thanks a lot.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Strategy Report. If you want to read more about the strategy of the Austrian Grand Prix, go to f1strategyreport.com and find Jack Leslie's write-up of all the action from the Red Bull Ring. Don't forget, you can now download the new version of Formula Legend for your mobile device on iOS or Android, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato. You can find me at Michael Laminato on Twitter. And be sure to join me in just 1 week's time as we look back on the British Grand Prix.